Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes swings us right back into the franchise that's nearly 60 years in the making. This new movie is set long after the previous installment and focuses on an extraordinary chimpanzee whose clan is enslaved by a ruthless ape king. But the spirit of Andy Serkis's revolutionary character Caesar still looms large over the film, for better and maybe for worse. I'm Aisha Harris, and today we're talking about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me today is Weilin Wong. She's the co-host of NPR's daily economics podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money. Welcome back, Weilin.
Hello, thank you.
Also with us is Jordan Morris. He's a podcaster, and his upcoming graphic novel, Youth Group, is available for pre-order now. Welcome back to you too, Jordan.
Hi, it's great to be here. I'm glad we could all be here together.
Podcasters together strong.
Together strong, yes. It is great to have you both here as well. Well, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes takes place hundreds of years after the death of Caesar, the rebellious ape leader and main protagonist from the most recent trilogy of Planet of the Apes movies. He was portrayed by Andy Serkis in those films, but did not return for this one. Now, there has been a power shift within this circle of life. The deadly simian virus introduced in the previous films has severely weakened and nearly decimated the entire human population, while apes are now thriving as the dominant and more highly intelligent species. Owen Teague plays Noah, a chimpanzee whose entire clan is suddenly attacked and enslaved by a mercenary ape king named Proximus Caesar. He is played by Kevin Durand. Noah sets out to get them back, and along the way teams up with a sage orangutan named Raka, played by Peter Macon, and a strange, scavenging human named May, who's played by Freya Allen. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes was directed by Wes Ball, who also directed the Maze Runner trilogy, and you can catch it in theaters now. Well, Weilin, I want to start with you. I know this movie has been sort of positioned by the filmmakers as being kind of a sequel, but not. They wanted to sort of keep the spirit of the last three films, especially with Caesar, alive. But this is like a totally new cast, very different story. How did this play for you?
You know, I think the visuals were amazing. It looks spectacular. I think the special effects are amazing. I really like the world building and the way they imagine these like rotting, overgrown human structures. Mm-hmm. I liked how, you know, the filmmakers imagine how the apes might have organized themselves in, you know, the preceding hundreds of years since Caesar. And, you know, you've got the clan that the protagonist belongs to, whose culture is built around raising eagles, which is kind of cool. They've got these very fashionable crossbody sling bags, which I was admiring. But I think that...
Great fashion.
Yeah, beautiful gowns. But, you know, my biggest complaint is that the main character, Noah, was very passive to me. And I think, you know, Caesar, he looms over the movie, and that I keep thinking about what a fabulous character Caesar was. He went on such an interesting, complex journey in those first three films. And so I'm looking for Noah, the protagonist in this movie, to do the same. And I just found him to be much more reactive than proactive. Like, stuff happens to him, and I never got the sense that he had any big moments of learning or that he went through a significant journey that was like worth rendering on film. He kind of starts out as a broody teen and ends as like a slightly less broody teen, and I needed more of like a transformation. So
yeah,
I think about how much I enjoyed the preceding three films, and those films I felt like were way better than they had any reason to be. You know, they really surprised on the upside. This movie felt like what we all expected those first three to be. You know what I mean? Like a little bit more rote, a little bit more flat on the page. And so it felt like kind of like a regression to the mean, you know, to pull a term from statistics, you know, that we're like regressing to kind of like a okay version of what this franchise is.
I have not heard that phrase since AP Stat in high school, so thank you
for bringing that back.
Let's do some SAT analogies. Why not?
Oh my God.
Is that more fun than talking about this ape movie?
Seriously. I mean, but it is tricky, right? Because his character is positioned as not knowing anything about the outside world, really. His whole clan has been sort of secluded from that, and that makes it very tricky when you have someone who, you don't want to say he's dumb, but he's very naive. And then we need that journey to be, I think, a little bit more plotted in a way than it is here. But Jordan, you know, what was this movie doing for you?
Yeah, so I agree with Waylon. Like, obviously, like, looks spectacular. The fashion is on point. Where was the 8th Met Gala? I think we all wanted that scene. But yeah, I felt about this movie like I felt about the other rebooted 8 movies that have come along in the past few years. It's like, I enjoyed it. I had a fun time. Mm-hmm. It left my brain on the way home from the theater. Yeah. Like, I think the food analogy is like nachos at a bar, right? Like, I like nachos at a bar. If someone's like, let's get nachos, I'm like, yeah, sure, why not? This will be fun.
Yeah.
You eat them, but, you know, you're not like thinking about the bar nachos a couple days later, yeah, right? Like, yeah. it's fun in the moment, but not much else. So, yeah, I admire the tech if you're looking for kind of a big splashy movie to see in a really nice movie theater. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, this is a good call. I did admire some of the performances that I think we could probably talk about later. There's some really good performances here by some kind of unexpected actors. But yeah, it's a fluffy movie that is, you know, maybe a little too long.
Ugh, definitely
a couple
too
many
long.
Subplots in there.
Yeah.
Some of them go somewhere, some of them don't. It's a nice forgettable time.
Yes. I have to agree with the too long part. I looked at my watch for the first time and I realized that there was still an hour and a half left of this 2.5 hour movie.
That like, sinking feeling.
Ouch. I think I was a little cooler on this film than both of you were. And I say this as someone who is on the record as having hated franchises, but I did really enjoy the last three films. Like Waylon said, they were better than they had any right to be. And I think there was part of that element of surprise or like low expectations that I think really made those films easy to enjoy. And of course, Andy Serkis was just really, really fantastic in those films. And they took a journey in a way. Now, I have not revisited them since each of them originally came out. So maybe if I went back, I would not feel as high on them. But I do think, unfortunately, what those films did was they kind of set a standard that this one can't quite meet. This felt to me sort of like screenwriting 101 in like the worst way possible, where I could see every single plot point, every placement of like, oh, there's eagles. And at one point he says, well, I don't sing the eagle song because my father was the one who was in. And I'm like, well, this is going to come back. And then it comes back in the way that like.
Chekhov's eagle song.
Thank you. That's exactly what it is. And it's like, you know, there's a reason why it's a formula and it sometimes works. But for here, like for me, I just felt everything felt very predictable in a way. And I also felt like the themes, while they are clearly, I think, relevant, and this entire franchise has been very much, you know, in many ways, speaking to race, class, issues around warfare and those sort of things. And I think, like, that's naturally embedded in this franchise. But at this point, I feel like this felt like it was kind of retracing some of the steps we've already seen. And while, yes, all of these issues are timeless, I don't know. I think I wanted a little bit more out of it than we get. And for me, I think my favorite character was probably Raka, who is played by Peter Macon.
Me too. He's great.
He was great. He was funny. And I wanted more of him. And again, another character who I was like, as soon as he showed up, I was like, I wonder how long he's going to be in this film. But what are some of the other performances that you all were really into?
Oh, yeah. I will also shout out Peter Macon. I think he's great in this. And I think, he adds a little comic relief. These movies are so serious. These are the most dire, serious talking monkey movies ever made.
It's the end of the world.
Yeah. He adds a little bit of lightness. He adds a little bit of fun. And I think I really like who they cast in this movie. Like, Peter Macon is just that guy from That Thing. He's a voice actor. He's a working actor. Like, there's a more cynical way to cast this movie, which is like, just get Chris Pratt to do it all.
Can you imagine?
You know, I like that it's not stunt cast with a bunch of celebrities who just, you know, get in a booth for a day, but it's like actual actors giving actual performances, and I think it's much better for it. And Peter Macon, I think, is the best example. I do want to shout out Freya Allen, the kind of lone human character. I think she does a great job, and the character is kind of ambiguous. There's a little bit of is she a hero? Is she a villain? Yeah. She kind of plays both sides in a fun way, and I think she does a good job there, and especially like acting with a bunch of digital characters is really believable. Yeah, I think that Noah, our lead, I think the problem is just like underwritten character. He's just hero guy. He's just naive hero guy who you know, spoiler alert, rises to the occasion.
You know what I mean? I felt like he could have risen a little more to the occasion.
There's some other elements in the big climactic moment that are doing way more heavy lifting than he is. But yes.
I think I definitely agree with Jordan that these characters are underwritten because the performers are doing a marvelous job, I think. And these apes are like very well animated. They're very emotional. Sure. They're doing the most. For example, I really liked Kevin Durand as Proximus, you know, and I liked his bluster. I liked, and I think that, you know, from a script perspective, I think they were trying to do like a, is Killmonger correct kind of a thing with Proximus, yes. right? Where you're right. supposed to be like, okay.
Hashtag
like,
Proximus was right.
Let's try to make that trend. And, you know, so you're like, okay, the movie is asking us to think about what do we want this new world order to look like? Mm-hmm. And what do these different groups of apes want? What do the humans want? What do they want in relation to each other? And there are some very meaty, interesting questions in there. The performers do a great job with the script they're given. But because the script is not really set up to confront those questions in a deep way, that limits kind of the ultimate effect of the movie, right? Mm-hmm. So because they feel like everyone's acting their heart out and the script is just not there to meet them, because I am interested in delving into those questions. And there's another human character that gets introduced later on that I think is supposed to be kind of a foil to May, or you're supposed to at least kind of feel like they are engaged in a debate, a philosophy around what is the role of humans mm-hmm. and how much should we kind of give in to the apes in this power structure, or how much should we try to rebuild what once was. Again, a fascinating question that I wish the movie had done literally anything with, except just walk us up to it and then kind of back off in this half-hearted way.
Yeah. Well, I think, like, without spoiling anything, I think by the end of the film, I felt as though this was just one long prologue toward what they're trying to actually get to. And, of course, these movies are set up to be to multiply. They don't die, they multiply. And so, like, there will most likely be another one. And I think the way it ends is that it sets everything up in that way. But then you have this full 2.5 hours where it's like, wait, so what are we doing here? And I'm like, yes, I understand the world building and the idea of like taking your time. And I don't need every action movie to be just like, go, 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 go. But I also think like this is the type of movie that can maybe test people's patience, especially since there are so few human characters and there are long stretches of not a lot of dialogue or just kind of like very condensed dialogue. So yeah, it's, I don't know. It definitely feels like a movie that maybe had this been more of a series situation, we might've gotten a little bit more going on with that human versus ape question. But instead we get like this mythology around Caesar and how he's kind of turned into Jesus and everyone's mm-hmm. sort of twisting his words. Like how did you think about the way Caesar really kind of hangs over this film in spirit and in like this, of course, like very obvious sort of allegory to religion or any sort of deified figure?
Yeah, I mean, it's a neat idea, and I like that the movie is, like, thinking about that, right? And I think that also the recent Dune movie did a great job with some of this stuff. It's like, how do we use myth? How do we use history? How do we use religion to motivate people? And some people use it for good, and some people use it for bad. And I think that it's nice that the movie is thinking about that, but it doesn't seem to land on anything interesting other than, like, pretty messed up how some people use religion for evil, huh?
Yeah, they end up building a forced labor camp. Whoops!
So yeah, and maybe if you're like 12 and studying some of this stuff in school, this will blow your mind. But I think it all is you know, kind of pretty obvious commentary. But yeah, and I think I should say that like the Peter Macon character, who I think we all loved, like it's a pretty thankless role. Like he just has to like dump this exposition, and that's
Apes-position.
Like what he's there for.
I think I wrote that in my notebook.
Oh, all the puns.
And Waylon, we have been really slacking with the monkey puns. So thank you. Thank you for getting us back on track. I'll try to say going
pleasure.
Bananas at some point.
Yeah.
We'll all like that. But yeah, he is definitely one of the 5 or 6 subplots in this movie that just like don't go anywhere. They just kind of cut off. And I don't know. It's just kind of like satire, huh? Right?
Yes.
And I'm like, I know.
The Caesar question is, for me, a big, frustratingly unanswered question in this movie, because the protagonist, Noah, is presented with at least two interpretations of Caesar. One comes from Raka the orangutan, who's like, Caesar was this like benevolent figure who showed us how we can all coexist peacefully. And then you get Proximus, who, you know, is maybe twisting Caesar's legacy to be about his own personal gain and personal power, and has built this kind of like cult or organized religion, or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, as a viewer, I want Noah to make a choice, right? Uh-huh. Or to engage in his own learning about Caesar, to try to discover for himself who Caesar was, and then make a choice about which version of Caesar do I follow?
Yeah.
And instead, he's more like this empty vessel that characters like pour exposition about Caesar into. And then, like, does he make a choice at the end? I don't know. It's a little bit muddled.
Yeah, definitely. It's somewhere along the line when Proxima Caesar was talking, I was just like, oh, so you're just King Louis from Jungle Book who wants the power of man's fire. Okay, sure. Let's do this. So do we have any last thoughts before we part? Any more puns we need to get out?
I'm trying to work prehensile in there somewhere. I just haven't been able to do it. yeah, I. So it's interesting, I think, that none of us have brought up the original Planet of the Apes movies that kind of came out in the 60s and 70s. I loved those as a kid. They're such great, like, cable movies. Something that that franchise did was it got insane. Like, the sequels to that movie, I think I would describe as cocaine-y. They are.
Well, those were in like the 70s, right? Some of them. Yeah. Yeah.
They were absolutely from the 70s. And like, there's a Planet of the Apes sequel where mutated humans live under the earth and worship an atomic bomb. I think that they should go there with these sequels. You don't have to do worshiping the atomic bomb, but just like, it's silly. There's 10 of these things. Go crazy.
Go
like,
bananas.
Go bananas. Yes. There we go. We got there. The prestige. Yes. so yeah, I, you know, they are so serious. They are these allegories. And so it's like, I don't know, maybe in the next couple, try and have a little fun. Just go crazy.
Yeah.
That would be my prescription for the next sequels that they are obviously going to make.
Yeah, yeah. As a fan of the Fast and Furious franchise, I'm always going to be on the side of, like, just get weirder in all ways possible.
Go to space. Bring people back from the dead. Who cares?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think we can all say that some of us enjoyed it a little bit more than others, but it was a time at the movies. We had it. And you should tell us what you think about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes once you've had a chance to see it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. And up next, we're going to be talking about what's making us happy this week. And now it's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy. Waylon, why don't you kick us off?
Well, Vanderpump Rules just had its season finale, and I wanted to shout out Brian Moylan, who does the recaps of Vanderpump for Vulture. That's what's making me happy this week and for actually this whole Vanderpump season. I came to Vanderpump late. I only started watching the aftermath of Scandoval, but I did go back and watch the old seasons, and I've been following the new season in real time. And what I adore about Brian's recaps is that, well, first of all, he's hilarious. So I'm like often doing these like spit takes when I'm drinking my coffee in the morning, reading his recaps. But, you know, he analyzes the show and the characters through the lens of this is a workplace drama. And especially this season has been about how essentially these colleagues are going to keep working together after a couple of them poisoned the whole environment. And I really enjoy stories about people's relationship to work. I mean, I'm an economics reporter, so I enjoy a labor story. And I think on a lot of reality shows, the fact that cast members are much more co-workers than friends or romantic partners, that's often more subtext than text, but Vanderpump actually makes it text, which I think is fascinating. And then Brian does this marvelous, funny job of talking about it from that lens. So that's Brian Moylan's recaps of Vanderpump Rules on Vulture.com. I'll read them forever.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Waylon. Jordan, what's making you happy this week?
The thing that's making me happy this week is a great new graphic novel that I got to read an early reader copy of. It is called The Worst Ronin. It is by Maggie Tokuda Hall and Faith Schaefer. It is a story about a kind of wannabe impetuous young samurai who teams up with a kind of hard-drinking, battle-scarred samurai to fight a demon. It's got this really fun, wacko, weird world building where it seems to take place in feudal Japan, but just everyone has cell phones and they don't explain it. It's such a funny choice. And the book is full of just funny, delightful, fun choices like that. It's a YA book, so I think it'd be a great like gift for a kid. But like, if you just want to read a samurai comedy about a farting demon, this is the book for you. But yeah, I think you could probably still get in a pre-order, but definitely pick it up on the 21st when it comes out officially. That is called The Worst Ronin by Maggie Tokuda Hall and Faith Schaefer.
Thank you so much, Jordan. Well, what's making me happy this week is that I recently got to spend some time with family who I don't see very often. And my uncle-in-law, we got talking about Luciano Pavarotti and went down like this rabbit hole about how much he loves Luciano Pavarotti. And look, I was familiar with him, three tenors, but like I wouldn't say I'd ever willingly put on Pavarotti. And we wound up spending probably about an hour watching a lot of Pavarotti and Friends, the series of benefits that he did in the 90s and in the aughts, where he was collaborating with the most random pop stars you could imagine. The Spice Girls, minus Jerry Halliwell, Stevie Wonder, Liza Minnelli, Barry White, Sheryl Crow, like bonkers. But I think two of my favorites are Pavarotti and James Brown singing It's a Man's, Man's, Man's World.
Wow.
And Celine Dion. He's singing I Hate You, Then I Love You from her fantastic album, Let's Talk About Love. And I think the Celine and Pavarotti duet actually makes more sense than a lot of the ones that he was doing. But I love the way, if you watch this on YouTube, she is like looking at him intensely the whole time. While he's like not really looking at her, he doesn't really look at other performers when he duets with them. He's just like in his zone. But I love it. And their voices just sound like butter. Let's actually hear a little bit of that. You make me mad. You make me long for you. You make me long for
you. You make me oh, that's so nice.
Gorgeous. Spread it on toast.
Oh, man. I love it. I just loved going down this rabbit hole. And I also just love it. It made me appreciate how he would collaborate with so many different people. And it just seems like he was so happy to do that and not have this hard line of like, well, I'm an opera singer and I can. He seemed to love music of all kinds and he appreciated artists of all kinds. And that's what's making me happy. So definitely just go down a rabbit hole of Pavarotti and Friends on YouTube. Too, but especially the Celine Dion I Hate You, Then I Love You duet. It's fantastic. If you want links for what we recommended, plus more recommendations, sign up for our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That brings us to the end of our show. Waylon Wong, Jordan Morris, thanks so much for being here. It was ape-tastic? I don't know if that works.
Ooh, we went from chimpanzee to chimpanzee.
This episode was produced by Hafsa Fathima and Ramel Wood and edited by Mike Katziff. Our supervising producer is Jessica Reedy, and Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Aisha Harris. We'll see you all next week.